Hey, you're on the front porch, where we talk about tough issues in and around Appalachia the way you and your friends do on your front porch. Support for our show comes from the Charleston Gazette-Mail with its dueling editorial pages, literally one on the left and one on the right. Check it out at wvgazettemail.com and download the CGM app for access to news, sports, and everything you need to stay informed. I'm Laurie Lynn, and today Brad McElhaney is back to hang out with us, statewide correspondent for Metro News. Hey, Brad.
Hi.
And as always, my friend Rick Wilson is here from the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick, where's
Scott? Hey, Laurie. Scott, I understand he's on a delicate diplomatic mission to Pyongyang this week, so we'll see how it goes.
Well, I'm sure it's hush-hush,
though. It's keep it on the down low.
Don't put it on the radio or anything, right?
Right.
So today we're going to look forward and backward. With Governor Justice's road bond plan up for a vote in a week and Republicans and Democrats all over the map on the issue, how is that party switch by the governor working out? So let's rewind to August 3rd, coming up on 2 months ago. Governor Jim Justice switched parties. He was elected as a Democrat, became a Republican after only, 7 months in office? Brad, you've covered Justice closely. I think it's fair to say the reception from the Republicans has been a spectrum from polite to fairly chilly. I don't know if he's really been effusively welcomed by very many of them. And a bunch of them are openly opposing him on this road bond referendum. A bunch of his top aides left or were asked to leave, including Chief of Staff Nick Casey, which I assume was pretty disruptive to the executive branch. Do you think Justice has gotten out of this switch what he wants, or is it just too early to say?
You know, to hear him say it, yes. And he continues to provide the same explanation, a consistent explanation, wherever he goes. Whether you agree or not, he says, I was very disappointed with my fellow Democrats during the state debate over the budget. He thought that he had the numbers to pass the revenue plan that he wanted and that his fellow Democrats let him down. You know, I kind of wonder about the logic of that and the numbers, but he believes it. Also, his connection with Donald Trump, the Trump family, and the White House is something that he plays up. And again, I do think he legitimately feels that connection. They are both people with business backgrounds, people who came to their current roles in politics, notably from outside of politics. They are not people who worry a whole lot about how am I going to say this and how is it going to be perceived.
Yeah, you mentioned doing the numbers on stuff. One thing that struck me about the last legislative session, if you look at who the majority is and who is effectively in control, I wonder about blaming the minority for not getting your agenda. Does that check out arithmetically, you know?
Yeah, I wonder that even at the time. And I will say the governor says that the Democrats were playing party politics on this. Their stated concern, and it actually ran somewhat parallel to the concern of Republicans in the House, was the plan called for reducing personal income taxes, which is a percentage basis. So, you know, if you make more money, you get a broader cut. As a practical matter, the wealthier get greater dollars reduced from what they have to pay to the government. So to still have a balanced budget, the idea was to bring up the sales tax. So the Democrats and the House Republicans were worried about the net result being regressive. Listening to the Democrats, I felt that they had legitimate concerns and that they weren't just playing party politics. But the governor describes it that way.
And said that, you know, and I think, I mean, Tim Armstead felt that, right? Wasn't that Armstead's?
Eric Nelson was pretty much there because it would have really opened up a huge budget hole in years to come, too. And
there was that concern.
I don't think
also
that really needed to be addressed, I thought.
So the governor's math is that if he had gotten every House Democrat and some House Republicans, then he would have gotten his idea through. So for whatever reason, the Democrats were expected to have a 100% success rate on being on board with the governor, whereas Republicans were expected to have maybe a 50-50 or less success rate, the Republicans having the majority in both the House and the Senate.
Well, isn't the way, it just feels like the way he thinks is, if you're on my team, the team being, you know, the D or the R, you are going to vote with me. And I think it sounds like he feels like he was betrayed because he was a Democrat and the Democrats didn't go along with him. So he's going to then switch parties and see if the Republicans will do any better of a job of going along with him.
There was also a big switch in his own playbook from the beginning of the regular session toward the special session as far as revenue, taxes, and budget, too.
Yeah, there was. And that's still a matter of fence mending, I suppose. The governor, again, when he has gone out to various places on the road bond tour, has said, well, you know, what did you expect me to do? We were upside down $500 million. Well, you know, there's a difference in perception there, too. Republicans will tell you that the reason that $500 million was there was a desire by the governor to spend more. he wanted the teacher pay raises. He wanted, at one point, $105 million for his SOS fund. So what is his philosophy? Does it suddenly become watching the spending, smaller government? Or does it remain almost a New Deal kind of desire to spend money to get the state rolling again? Does his philosophy suddenly become more Republican because he's taken on that label? What he says is, I'm going to be Jim. And I think that's probably what the truth is going to be.
What tack do you think Democrats are going to take, particularly in the legislative session, which is several months away? But, you know, are the gloves going to be completely off? Is it just going to be, we're going to oppose this guy with all we have? A lot of us never really trusted him or liked him anyway. Or is it going to be kind of more sit back, see what happens?
I would guess lukewarm at best. I can quote a story that was told to me by a former legislator, former Democratic legislator. Not me. This is not me talking. And it's rather snarky. He said that he thought that justice couldn't beat Bill Cole in the Republican primary, so he'd rent the Democratic Party for a while. So I think there are people who feel that way, and so that might affect the tendency to cooperate, although it depends on what he puts forward.
Toward the tail end of the special session, I saw some of the fierier Democrats walking out of caucuses with the governor, gatherings with the governor, because they were really upset. I don't know that they're going to be spiteful, but I think this now gives some of those Democrats the license to not feel beholden to somebody who's in their party. I think if they disagree, they're going to be more clear about it. I also would say that I've seen quite a few Democrats who have continued to be supportive of the road bond issue.
Yeah, but I don't know. But the road bond issue, it seems like people are kind of not slotting into their party lines. You saw Senator Kessler seems to be critical of it or outright opposed to it. The union types are not being as supportive as you might think. I mean, what does he do after all this rhetoric about how the state's going to end up in a ditch and if it doesn't pass? Is it like Donald Trump erasing his tweets last night after Luther Strange lost the Alabama primary? Do we just forget it and move on?
I missed that whole episode.
Yeah, he deleted a bunch of tweets that were.
Yeah, so if the governor was not able to get a whole lot of his initiatives like teacher pay raises and SOS funding, didn't get his plan for the state budget, and now if his big road bond issue is in peril, then where does he go with his goals from here? You know, he'll say, well, I'm not worried about getting reelected, which is possibly true, but I still think he'd like to be in office and achieving his goals.
Right.
Yeah.
That becomes more difficult, and the party backing in the legislature certainly is very up in the air, with Democrats now not feeling they've got to be on board with him, and Republicans fairly split. The Senate has been more supportive in general, along with its president, Mitch Carmichael. The House has had an independent streak. So I think you still see that, even if the governor has joined the Republican Party with majorities in both houses, I still think you see some combativeness.
So back to the road bond, one reason I think where some traditional people who would have been all over it are maybe lukewarm is that it doesn't look like there's a lot of provisions to encourage local jobs for local workers. And if you get a big infusion at one time, the local workforce couldn't absorb. A lot of it would wind up going out of state. And how do you think that will shake down, not just in rhetoric, but reality?
Yeah, that's another question the governor gets on his tour of the state. And what he says is, we're going to employ every West Virginian possible. And we've got training programs to try to bring people on board who don't already have the contracting skills. He says, yes, there may be jobs that are so big that contractors from Ohio or someplace get these bids. But within those, we hope that they will subcontract to West Virginia contractors. Regarding the employees, what he says is, you know, we still want as many jobs as possible. And if folks from Ohio or Pennsylvania come in and take these jobs, well, they're still going to pay payroll taxes. They're still going to eat at our restaurants. And maybe some of them will love the state so that they remain here. Now, this again is a leap of faith. I think what he's saying makes some sense, but again, you got to believe him. 48,000 jobs is what he said all along. And again, I think that's a mathematical issue that may vary from reality. But
the math seems to come up periodically in this conversation.
Yeah, 48,000 would be impossible to fill with only West Virginia workers. I mean, just to have that many people who are skilled enough in construction, or that many, you know, strong, presumably mostly male of a certain age bodies.
We're not already working too.
Yeah, it's really difficult to scrape up that many West Virginians to do those jobs.
Yeah, one thing that's unfortunate about our state is we've got 50% of West Virginians are not working for whatever reason. Some because they've reached the age that they don't have to work anymore, but others who are potentially able-bodied who are just not in the workforce. Our workforce participation is sadly low. These jobs that could come of the highways projects are one potential solution to that. But, you know, you wonder if the folks who are not filling jobs already, for whatever reason, will gain the skills and the drive and the motivation and the access to take these jobs.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, more from Brad, and we're going to reach back and talk about his career so far in West Virginia journalism. But first, you're listening to The Front Porch right now because thousands of people, both here in West Virginia and outside it, are members of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. It's super easy to become a member. Just make a donation of any amount at least once a year. You'll get a really well-written thank you letter from Scott Finn. There are also other perks depending on how much you donate. But most of all, you'll have the satisfaction of knowing that you're helping tell West Virginia's story. If you're not a member yet, go to wvpublic.org and click the donate button. And we thank you for listening and supporting us. So speaking of telling West Virginia's story, Brad has been covering West Virginia for a couple of decades.
Sound old.
Yeah, so I was
we didn't even have Twitter when I started.
I was doing my questions last night and I realized it sounds like we're putting you out to pasture. So I want to note that you're actually in the prime of your career and this is not your retirement video.
He began at age 12.
But so you're a Parkersburg native, went to Marshall, and then came here to Charleston, right?
Came here to Charleston because it's, you know, if you're a West Virginia native and you want to stay in journalism, it's
the center of the
probably
world.
Where you want to be. Yeah. So I worked in newspapers, and those were still a thing at the time. They still are, haha, newspaper friends.
Right. So you were at the Daily Mail for almost your entire career and saw it transition.
All right, kids, sit down.
Did they have computers?
So, yeah, when I started, we did have computers, but there was one desk that had access to the internet and email. You would go to this one computer when it was not occupied, and you'd bring up Yahoo at that point and dial into whatever you needed.
Wow.
So, yeah. Boy, I sound like a geezer. But so the Daily Mail was an afternoon newspaper, and we would compete for the latest breaking news for the afternoon cycle. Now everybody is competing in the digital sphere to try to be up by minutes. We would try to hit that 6 to 12 hour cycle, but now 5 to 10 minutes is an eternity.
When you started out, did you ever think that you would be covering a Republican House of Delegates, Senate, and now a Republican governor here?
Oh my
in West
gosh,
Virginia?
No way. And you know, most of the congressional delegation now is, whereas we used to have the mainstays of Senator Byrd and Senator Rockefeller, it's just all changed, and it seemed to change almost overnight. I don't know.
It really was when I got to West Virginia.
You're an opinion leader. You're a thought leader.
Yeah, thanks, Lori.
Well, I'm about to leave, Rick. So.
I don't know that West Virginians have changed really that much, but certainly the habit of West Virginians of voting for Democrats was deeply ingrained for generations. But in 2014, you know, it was a wake-up call that both houses of the legislature flipped. And, of course, we voted in a Democrat as governor, but he decided to make the switch. So he's now a Republican, too.
And 2014 was also, as you said, when the U.S. Senate at Capito won that year, mm-hmm. and now we have all three of the House of Representatives seats are Republican as well.
Yeah, and I guess that's a flaw that we all have, is you're used to what you're used to. I'm still astounded to see Republicans in each. Now, I think that as we progress, what is interesting is I am quickly learning that not all Republicans think the same way. You know, parties exist as a big tent for people of different philosophies. And you certainly saw that on the budget issues in West Virginia between the Senate and the House, both dominated by Republicans, but Republicans who apparently think very differently about the tax structure in the state. You saw it the year before, I think, to some degree on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Mm-hmm. The House was far more into wanting to get that passed, and the Senate was where it finally failed.
No, I think that's a good example. But I have this theory that we should change our state motto from "Mountaineers are always free" to "You can't make this shit up." And so do you have anything that might fit under those categories as far as stories you've covered? Or?
Oh, you know, looking back a decade ago, the lottery win of Jack Whitaker, who was at that point, he became a household name in West Virginia, was just wild, because it was the day after Christmas or the day after New Year's, and we heard that there was this enormous jackpot had built up, and so it was news in itself. And then we heard there was a winner in West Virginia, and I wound up the day after the holiday going out to the gas station in Putnam County where it had the winning ticket had been sold, and there were TV live shots out of there, and again, the Daily Mail was an afternoon newspaper, so I tried to slip into CNN's live shot holding up a copy of our paper with Whitaker on the front. You know, and he was this larger-than-life character who had already amassed $1 million and then lost $1 million through his business and then came into more money than anyone could have imagined. I actually knocked on his door in Scott Depot that night, and he was the one who came to the door, again, wearing a cowboy hat, greeted me, but gently suggested I go away, which is not the first or last time that's happened. But the idea was that he, because he had had money already, he would know how to use it and would adjust. And that story proved to be not true.
That was really sad, wasn't it?
Tragedy after tragedy befell him and his family.
Do you have a most memorable day in your career? Was it 9/11? Was it something more?
9/11 is what really came to mind, and I suppose in part because we just passed yet another anniversary. Mm-hmm. But again, this was, I'm ancient, so this was pre-internet times. So we had one TV in the newsroom, and we had it, I think, on the NBC affiliate. And initially, you know, people thought that it was maybe a private Cessna that had hit the first tower. Mm-hmm. And so we took a passing interest in it. And then when the second plane hit, it was just horrifying. You know, just this feeling of this is much bigger came over us. And I think this was true of every place in America. You know, one of the planes wound up hitting the Pentagon, and so it appeared to be a much broader effort, and we weren't sure what was going to happen. And even a town the size of Charleston, we became very uncertain. And so reporters like me were sent, for example, to the Capitol, to the tallest buildings, to the area's chemical plants, because we didn't know if this was a broader effort. These days, we would have been producing regular updates on our website, push notifications, tweeting, that kind of thing. All we could do at that point was to put edition after edition after edition of the afternoon newspaper out, changing the information as we got it, and then preparing for the next day, which still seemed like a major effort. Normally, we would do two editions of the afternoon paper. We went maybe to four or five that day,
wow,
just keeping the press running.
Finally, you have two school-age daughters. What would be your reaction if one of them came to you and said, "Dad, I want to do what you did. I want to go into journalism here in West Virginia"? Would you be psyched and say, "Yay," or would you say, "Oh gosh, honey, maybe you want to, you know, rethink that"?
You know, one thing I would say is that West Virginia really needs it. West Virginia needs the spotlight that journalists provide on its communities, on its government, on its leaders. And unfortunately, with the difficult economic conditions both for news and in the state, West Virginia's journalism has been to some degree contracting. What I do say to them and to students that I speak to, I would advise people to have a great basis of education and critical thought, but to be prepared for change throughout your career, because I think that change is coming almost no matter what your career is, we're just in that cycle where things change so rapidly. You've got to have that basis of knowledge, but the flexibility to switch careers.
Winter is coming, Brad.
That is true, Rick.
God, let's not go there again, please. Hey, Rick, do you have a Bible verse for this week?
Actually, in lieu of a Bible verse, I'm thinking of something that Saint-Just said during the French Revolution. He was one of the radical Jacobins. I believe he said, "No one governs innocently."
So that's solace for our governor. You're not alone in making hard choices. And that's The Front Porch. You can listen to Brad McElhaney's reporting on your local Metro News affiliate and read his byline all the time on WVMetroNews.com. Thank you, Brad, for joining us today.
Right. Thanks, you guys. Great.
And thanks to Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. And thank you for listening. I'm Laurie Lynn. We'll catch you next week.